Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to Classical Ideas. This is Greg Soden. Mindfulness in 2019 is everywhere. It helps people in a variety of ways. Mindfulness and meditation are being researched by universities around the world for effects on the brain, and techniques are even being used in psychotherapy sessions. Yet many people who use the techniques are unaware of the ancient roots of the term. Seeing how and what to pay attention to in the world is based on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra, known as the Satipatthana Sutta. Today's subject is the new book, Mindfulness and Intimacy, from Soto Zen teacher Ben Connolly. Ben's book tries to show how everything in the world is connected and how to help people see that their actions in any given moment is connected to everything else in the world. Mindfulness and Intimacy covers topics such as the self, the body, the mind, the heart, dying, nature, family, friends, romance, and art. Ben's book is also incredibly accessible for even the most beginning of readers on the topic of meditation, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and Zen. Ben Connolly is a Minneapolis-based Soto Zen teacher in the Katagiri lineage. He offers a wide variety of secular mindfulness trainings, including for police departments, corporate settings, correctional facilities, and addiction recovery groups. He teaches at the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center and is the author of Inside the Grass Hut, Inside Vasubandhu's Yogacara, and most recently, Mindfulness and Intimacy, out now from Wisdom Publications. We talked about a little bit of all of the above in this conversation, and I think you'll really enjoy it. So without further delay, please enjoy my chat with Ben Connolly. Ben Connolly, thank you so much for coming on Classical Ideas.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
Can you just start off by introducing yourself a bit for the audience so we know who you are?
Yeah, so I'm a guy who lives in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where spring is arriving. And I'm a Soto Zen Buddhist priest in the Katagiri lineage. I received Dharma transmission from Tim Burkett at the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, where I still teach. And I also I do a lot of secular mindfulness training. So at various places, like I do a lot of work with I used to do some correction stuff. Now I do a lot of stuff with people in recovery from addiction, and also police training, and then various other wellness and corporate type things.
Wonderful. So I kind of am interested in your backstory, especially when it comes to practicing like Zen or Buddhism in the United States. What was your religious upbringing like? Was it in Zen?
No, I was raised by a couple of secular humanists. So I was raised without a religious tradition, but with a strong sense of values. My mother was like an activist to some extent. And yeah, so kind of a progressive secular upbringing.
Awesome.
And I came in late.
Okay. How did you specifically find Zen? Like, when did you first come across the practice? Did it grab your attention right away? What did you like about it?
Well, weirdly, I started practicing Zen when I was about 32 or something, which was a little over 15 years ago. But strangely, I distinctly remember I remember hearing about Zen a couple times when I was a little kid, and it's just odd that these memories stand out so strongly for me. So there may have been some kind of inkling there. Yeah, I remember some guy making a joke about, you know what the sound of one hand clapping is? And I was like, talking about that. And then he explained the famous koan of what's the sound of one hand, and then he proceeded to clap loudly with one hand, which he thought was hilarious. And I was like, now I know what Zen is. Then there was also a professor, a religion professor at the college where my parents taught, Grinnell College in Iowa. And he is he's a Jewish man, a Holocaust survivor, and he was practicing Zen. And he would go to Japan and train. And it was really hardcore, classic Zen, where it was very strict. And they used the Kyosaku stick to tap you on the shoulders to wake you up. And everyone thought, wow, this guy's really kind of going off the deep end. But he's a really wonderful man, so I remember that. But personally, I encountered it basically, I was suffering tremendously. I have a long history of chemical dependency. I've been sober for 20 some years, and mental illness. And so I was just sort of desperately looking around for ways to be well. And I used a lot of different things. Like, I've done a lot of 12-step recovery stuff and psychotherapy, but doing all those was still not enough. I was still just struggling. And so I started meditating, and from meditation, I got interested in Zen. I also thought maybe a religious tradition could be supportive for me. And so I was reading religious literature from all over the world, and the literature of Zen really just clicked for me, and that opened the door. Then I started meeting actual people. And that's when it really took off.
That is really interesting. I appreciate your candidness there as well, because you don't have to share things like that about your life if you don't want to. So I appreciate you opening up on that. And, you know, your response kind of reminded me of my friend Chris Grasso, who wrote a book last year called Dead Set on Living, where he is very open and transparent about his own chemical dependencies as well. So that is really interesting. So thank you so much for sharing that, Ben.
Yeah.
And I know that you mentioned earlier the Katagiri Soto lineage. What is that for listeners? I don't think I've ever had a description of Katagiri Soto on the show before, so I'm just kind of curious if you can lay out what that is.
Yeah, well, Soto Zen is one of the two largest sects of Zen coming out of Japan. I would say Soto Zen is distinguished by an emphasis on doing realization or doing enlightenment now. So as opposed to some schools of Buddhism that are more emphasize practicing in order to attain states of enlightenment. So that would be a distinction. So we really emphasize wholehearted doing of each thing, cooking, picking up this cup of water I'm picking up right now, and so forth. So the Soto, the Katagiri lineage, in the U.S., we often refer to our lineages just in terms of the Japanese teacher who transmitted authority to people here in the U.S. like in the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. So Katagiri, he originally came to the United States to be an assistant to Shunryu Suzuki, who founded the San Francisco Zen Center. It was definitely one of the most prominent Japanese teachers in American history. And then Katagiri, some people in Minnesota convinced him to move here. They said, there are enough people who want to do this. You could come and start something. And he moved to Minnesota. And at the time, there was, my understanding is, Minnesota Zen Center that he founded was the first Zen practice center in the U.S. outside of the coasts, although it's possible that would be contested. Anyway, so I moved here and passed the teaching on to people, and that's the lineage I'm in.
Wonderful. Okay, so let's dive into a little bit about your brand new book. I know you have a few books out, but you're the author of a brand new book from Wisdom Publications titled Mindfulness and Intimacy. So first of all, congratulations on its release. That's really cool.
Thanks.
And so as the author, what do you see as being the overarching goal of the book? What are you shooting for as the writer?
Well, I want to allow the reader to develop ways to see how and what to pay attention to promote wellness for themselves and everyone. So mindfulness is basically about how you pay attention, and it's based in the idea that you can train your mind to be more focused on the things in any given moment that would be helpful, and to be focusing on them in a way that would be more helpful. So that's the kind of the mindfulness side. And then the intimacy side is, I'm using the term in a way that's totally conventional in Zen discourse and might be surprising to most people. So intimacy here refers to the fact that everything is always already completely intimate. So because everything arises dependent on everything else, which if you give it some thought, you'll start to see that that's pretty clearly, most people would be like, yep, that seems to be the way it is. That means everything is already totally closely knitted. Or as Dr. King says in the letter from Birmingham jail, we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. So intimacy, the intimacy side is about helping people see that whatever they're doing in any given moment is always connected to everything else. So that helps us to begin to focus on doing things, including paying attention, in a way that helps everything, so that we don't have to kind of feel like, oh, I'm taking care of myself now, or I'm taking care of someone else. We can just realize we can always be taking care of everything.
What did you notice was lacking in society that made you start thinking about intimacy? Like, did you notice something was lacking in our lifestyles to where that topic became really important and helped you make this book take shape?
Yeah, that is an insightful question. So, yes, in many ways. I mean, one, I think that, alienation, that is to say a sense of separation and non-connectedness, is a natural, it's been prevalent in all human life from my observation, just reading literature all along. And it's a central theme of Buddhism, but it's actually heightened in American society. This is actually one of the ways we have a hyper individualized society. So people's sense of intimacy is diminished. But actually, I would say this book also is in particular a response to the way mindfulness is being appropriated into American and Western culture. So mindfulness is a particular practice that's part of Buddhist teachings that doesn't have anything religious about it in particular, except for that it's embedded in that body of literature and tradition. But the thing is, there's a very reasonable critique coming around, as you probably know, we have mindfulness being taught in schools, at corporations. As I said, I do it with police, all kinds of places. And then you see, if you read the newspaper, if you read any wellness article, it seems like half of them mention that you should do mindfulness. They'll either name it specifically or they'll actually say the things that mindfulness is without mentioning that's what they're saying. Anyway, the critique that would be easy to make of the way mindfulness is being appropriated is in the U.S., we could very easily make this a thing where we use mindfulness to help people to be more accepting of how things are. And actually, how things are is not something that I want people to accept.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Because we exist intimately already in systems that are oppressive. So when Dr. King talks about the inescapable network of mutuality, he's not like saying, yay, it's all flowers. His point is, in that essay, the letter from Birmingham Jail, that because that's true, he has to go out and work for people's liberation. So mindfulness, if it's understood, in my opinion, the best way, calls your attention to the fact that you're intimately involved with things, and that will help us to work our way out of these systems that we're all part of, which white supremacy, patriarchy, transphobia, homophobia, and I could go on for a long time. And the massive degradation of our planet and our environment, all these things, we're intimate with that. So mindfulness shouldn't be helping us to just be more chill. It should be helping us to be more engaged and liberative.
Wonderful. Okay, and the first words in your book, which I've really enjoyed for the last couple of weeks, really jump out at me in response to exactly what you just said. So the first words in the book are, here we are together through words. And so here you and I are together through voice, through the internet. What are you inviting the reader to consider with this intimate beginning of being together?
Well, I think one of the things I want to say is, like, you're going to read this book about mindfulness and intimacy. You might be like, oh, the author of this book knows something about intimacy, and he will explain to me how to do it. And my point is, we're already intimate. We're already connected. You're reading this. I'm sitting here writing this. I'm having this experience thinking about you, and you're reading it. That connection is already there. It's not something that you have to look for far away. It's here.
Yeah, you know, in reading it, being there with you, that lured me in as a reader, you know, and I immediately felt a sort of like a kinship with you as the writer, because I felt like you cared about me as the reader, even before you ever even knew that I was a person in the world. So that was pretty cool.
Well, that's lovely to hear that that's the way you felt it. And it's a fascinating thing. I think that's exactly what I'm hoping people to realize is, you can't know, none of us can know the 5 billion other people on the planet, and yet we can still love them.
Yeah.
And we can get out of that love.
Yeah. Okay. So there's something in the book that comes up a lot, and it's a recurring motif, and that is the Buddhist Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra, otherwise known in Pali as the Satipatthana Sutta. And these are body, feelings, mind, and phenomena or Dhamma. Can you tell me a little bit about your experiences, study, and thoughtfulness about this sutta and why you chose to weave it throughout the book? Because I don't get the impression a lot of people are reading the Pali Canon. So, you know, like there's a lot of like the whole like critique is like the McMindfulness movement, which I've been reading about a lot in the new book, American Dharma by Anne Gleig, where, you know, she writes about that. But you have this sacred ancient text, Satipatthana Sutta, woven throughout the book. So tell me why.
Yeah, I just want to say a shout out to Anne Gleig, who's she was the keynote at a recent Soto Zen Buddhist Association conference of teachers, and she is wonderful. I'm waiting to get that book yet, but I'm confident it will be great.
Anyway, it is good. I'm reading it right now. It's spectacular.
Yeah. So your question, why did I want to weave that text through? Well, to me, part of the way that as Westerners we're appropriating Buddhist thought and Buddhism into our culture, how do I put this? Not about the part of it. We should be really careful and respectful in how we do that. So one of the tendencies of American culture, you could say white culture, is to think that, like, basically we can subsume anything in the world and just take it in and then we'll do it better. Mm-hmm. So you kind of look at like blues music. There are people making amazing blues music, and then it's like, white people, we can take it. Now we own it. We don't give people credit that they wrote it, and we'll do it better. So we should be the famous ones. We should get all the money. So that's just one example, but you could go down the line and do this all day. So the thing is, this can very easily happen with mindfulness or other elements of Buddhist teaching. So one, I want to respect the human beings who are doing the practice in Asia, the human beings who transmitted it through my lineage and other people's lineages, and also the textual tradition, because that's part of how that came. So basically, if we're going to say in the U.S. that we're doing mindfulness, I just like think it's really important to do it by looking at what mindfulness has been for 2,500 years, instead of being like, all right, we've got some ideas about it, and now it's ours. So I want to keep referring back to that root, not because it's perfect, but as a way of doing the process respectfully, and also because there's profound wisdom there.
Yeah. And, you know, the cultural appropriation thing is super important to discuss in all aspects of academia and in our public life, because it's, just like you said, super respectful and important to do so. Especially to give homage to the people that come before us, where all these ideas are derived from. So your book is also incredibly modern, because as I was reading it, I was thinking about how the world has a tendency to throw little irritations at us. And you write in the book, there's a quote that jumps out at me, and you write, quote, "Understanding how to focus our awareness, how to practice mindfulness, can help us shed unpleasant emotional states and habits of thought, and can help us take care of things." So to me, this makes a lot of sense in like daily irritants, like being in frustrating traffic or being late or forgetting to do something important, or even just like dealing with like 100 emails a day and other stuff. What practices do you see as being most helpful to you when handling these types of things we all face every day? Like, how do you go about using these practices for modern irritations?
Well, first I'm going to say something like overarching. So kind of the basic idea of how I understand mindfulness and intimacy, or I could say mindfulness and interdependence, is based in really my favorite Buddhist thinker, a fellow named Vasubandhu from about 1500 years ago. And he basically said, mindfulness is really effective at helping you shed patterns of emotional reactivity. Mindfulness is good for helping you shed patterns of emotional reactivity. And awareness of intimacy or independence is helpful to shed your sense of alienation. And those two things, alienation and emotional reactivity, feed each other. But if you kind of separate them out, they can be useful to see through those two lenses. So mindfulness is really good for this thing you're talking about here. And one, it really helps to have a formal meditation, mindfulness practice, or an environment where you say, now my focus is on how I'm developing awareness. So the thing is, usually, like if you get formal training, you're going to start with the body. That's the first foundation of mindfulness, and it's very effective. And then I just, because the four foundations of mindfulness is actually quite complex, I break it down similarly to how Vasubandhu does. He basically says, you want to start by being aware of your body and your senses. So, and that has a very Zen flavor. You just like, I'm looking out the window, really looking at the shape of the tree as it is right now and the way the light's falling on it, and letting my attention rest in the moment. That actually already will diminish emotional reactivity, because there's a pause in the all the thinking I have that drives my reactivity in a loop. So just like you say, if you're in a meeting and you're starting to get really irritated with everybody, you can just stop and like you bring your attention into the body. And it's like, if nothing else, there's a break in your thinking about how everyone else is stupid and wrong. So that's helpful. But then the next step that really does usually take some cultivation is then being really mindful of the emotional state you're experiencing. And this is why I say mindfulness has a what and a how. So the what is the thing you're choosing to pay attention to, and the how is with non-judgmental, compassionate awareness. So we begin to be able to be aware in any moment of what the emotional state is, and it's the experience of it. So not just naming it, although naming it is okay, but actually knowing what it is and holding it in awareness with non-judgment and compassion. And nothing, in my experience, will be more powerful at diminishing your patterns of emotional reactivity than that very act.
It's like giving yourself a superpower almost, where you can, like, you know, channel and harness your own anger and frustration, right?
Yeah, you're using it for liberation. Because the thing is, that whatever thing came up is what's here. So there's never an opportunity to do something liberative or healing outside of what's here. This is the time. And it's like, well, that's the thing that's got the most heat. That's the one that's going to motivate me to do something unhelpful or confusing. And even if it's not motivating me badly, it's just unpleasant. So I can do something liberative right here.
So one of the biggest things that people can do, I feel like, over my years of talking about these topics, is like a deep Zazen practice. So one of my favorite things about Buddhism-associated practice, like Zazen, is that somebody can do them intensely, but also not necessarily call themselves a Buddhist. You know, like, I don't call myself a Buddhist, but I've done Zazen a lot. But I've not really had a deep connection to other things like liturgy, like bowing. In fact, you even say early in the book that non-religious people can just as easily do the practices in your book as a dedicated Buddhist. And I know that this is sort of a conflict, like with the whole like McMindfulness thing and the debates that took place around that. Have you worked closely with people who do the practices outlined in the book but don't identify as Buddhist?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yes. Yeah. I mean, they're just things you can do. I mean, it's a peculiar thing. So I was on this thing called the Minnesota Multi-Faith Network. So we're a statewide group of faith leaders in Minnesota and organizations. And we were having our annual meeting and people were just talking. We were like at the kind of conversation part of the tables and someone was like, you know what I want to do is these Buddhists have been so good at making their thing, like bringing the psychology out of it and then having it be like a secular thing. And I want to figure out how to do that with Christianity, which I thought was interesting. And I commend their project and I hope it's fruitful. But I have to say, like, Buddhism is a lot of things. But a huge part of it is principally and fundamentally psychological. So it's just unlike other religious traditions like that. There's many ways you can use religious traditions in a non-religious context, but Buddhism, from what I've seen, is distinct in the degree to which it is psychological, or actually more technical, phenomenological. But your question was, do I know people are doing this? Absolutely, lots. Like, I'm going to be co-leading a thing at a synagogue in Los Angeles in a month with one of the cantors there, who's a dear friend of mine. And I do this in secular contexts. I have a regular secular mindfulness sitting group in Minneapolis. So, yeah.
Do any of the people that you work with, did they ever describe to you how they see Buddhist practice fitting within a life that they don't identify as Buddhist?
Oh, I'm not sure I followed that question. Could you rephrase?
Can you tell me about how the people who they don't identify as Buddhist – But they do Buddhist practices. How do they reconcile that gap?
Oh, I think I actually don't know. I don't hear them talking about needing to reconcile almost at all. They're
gotcha.
They're like, I like sitting because it helps me be happier and more calm. And, you know, they might say I'm spiritual, but not religious, you know.
Yeah.
But mostly I just don't hear. I hang out with people doing this stuff all the time. I have many secular mindfulness clients that I go and teach this stuff. And I it's a funny question because it just doesn't even come up.
Speaking of calm, you just said the word calm and that jumped out at me. We live in a frantic society. You probably agree. And yeah. You wrote, when you stop to pay attention to how your body and mind are, you will find a little closeness with yourself. And to me, that was like an invitation to see how the franticness of the world is impacting me. And then later mm-hmm. in the book, you write, it's still pretty wondrous just feeling my back sinking into this chair right now as my eyes subtly move to follow these words I type. And I loved that. It was great. And so you're open to contemplating how wild and crazy it is that we even exist in the world and how magical all of this life and experience can be. So my question is, why is this important, addressing this franticness, and how does one stop to pay attention to one's body and mind?
Well, you know, there may be people listening to this who are, they're not frantic at all. I mean, we're pretty various, but we do have a culture that is kind of encouraging us feeling this way and living this way. And one of the main reasons it's problematic is just that it makes us alienated from ourselves and other people, because we're wrapped up in this churning thing about getting things done. We're missing a lot. And so that's why, like in the first quote, it's by being aware of the body and the mind that we start cultivating intimacy by being willing to care about and pay attention to ourselves. So being frantic, the word has this semantic range, this valence that's like, it's not good. It's got a negative connotation. But moving fast or being busy isn't bad inherently. So in the to use a Buddhist text, the Loving Kindness Sutra, it says someone who's wise and skillful at being kind should be unburdened with duties. Unburdened with duties. And so on the one hand, sometimes I need to like put down my duties so I can focus on the body. I need to actually make a space where, because otherwise the frantic habit will make it so I can't find intimacy with my body and mind. So I need to be like, now's the time where I sit on the cushion or I go on a retreat. But ultimately, you can be doing anything and realizing intimacy. But because it takes practice for most of us to kind of break the habit of the frantic mind and behavior, we need to make that space.
And I think that from what I gather in the book, I think one of your strategies for making space for yourself is music, right?
Yeah. Well, to me, that's true. I'm a semi-retired musician. Like by profession, I teach some students now, very rarely perform, but music, any arts, basically in the chapter on the arts, I just want to point out that in ways that are almost too many to list, making art or being around art or immersing ourselves in art, it evokes a lot of the qualities that the book is about, because people tend to be more, they're focused. They're focused in a way that is feels good. And there's a sense of connection. Those all often come through art making. I would say that's one of the fundamental functions. That's probably why art is such a big part of human culture.
Yeah. You know, and in the book, in the chapter on art, another quote jumps out at me. It's when you're talking about attention and the gift of attention and how you say, if we see beauty, if we give our attention to beauty, it will enter us and be a part of us, and we will be a little more likely to create beauty. And that spoke to me. So I'm 35 and I make a podcast and I love doing these conversations. I love playing music. I go to like concerts constantly in Buffalo. And I love going to art museums and writing a little bit of fiction. And I was also a 10th grade English teacher, and I was trying so hard to encourage all my students over the years that exactly what you say, if we give our attention to beauty, it will enter us and it will be a part of us and we will make beauty. And so tell me a little bit more about that. Like, how do you, you know, go about creating, and what inspires you to create?
Mm-hmm. I keep kind of dodging around your questions, but I'm going to circle back. I just want to say, by making beauty, I don't mean like just making a pretty painting. Yeah. I mean, like, to me, I'll use the term Zen, but also like Zen is a the art of performing liberation, and liberation is beautiful. So anyway, no, I did lose your question. So how do you go about making beauty? The thing is, for most people, it you want to kind of trust a sense of calling or interest. So like, what type of making actually compels you? But when the impulse comes up, honor it, right? So personally, I'll just say, like, I hated writing prose. I would laugh about people who wrote books. I was like, that sounds like so much work. And I was a songwriter, which is like, I would say writing songs is like standing in a thunderstorm with an umbrella. You know, you kind of make yourself receptive, but finally, there's so little of it, it just comes down. Whereas, you know, with writing prose, you just got to sit and write and write. But one day, about 10 years ago, just on a whim, I was like, boy, it'd be kind of fun to write some prose. I just sat on my porch. So I honored the impulse. And now I've written 3 books. And it absolutely came out of that first moment of having a slight impulse to just write. I was like, instead of being like, I don't want to do that, or I can't do that. Which is, that's the biggest thing, is this idea that you have to be good at something to do it. So my example that I became an author is not good because it makes it sound like that's the end goal, which it isn't. But honoring your impulses to just make something, or even, you know, my wife now is into photography, and we're just walking and she sees the beauty in something, and then she wants to engage with it in a way that makes an image that's beautiful.
You know, and something you said just jumped out at me too. So your aversion to writing years ago, that was not a permanent state that you found yourself in forever.
There aren't any of those.
You know? And so like that to me jumps out, and your chapter on not knowing really jumps out at me there, because you know, you would say something when you were like 35, you would never say at 45, and you would say something at 45 that you would cringe at when you're 70. And so, yeah. You know, our states of mind are so fleeting. And so, you know, the more I read, the more people like you that I speak to, the more places I travel to, the less I feel like I know for sure. And so, like, societies that we hold have traditions that we hold dear, but recently I heard someone say tradition is the tyranny of the dead. And that like blew my mind. You know? So even when I hear myself speaking and ideas are coming out, I can't help but think, did I think that by myself, or did I hear someone else say that and I'm just re-saying it now? What do I know that is original to me? And if I really investigate that question, I have to say that there's really not that much that I know that is definitely original to me, because we're all products of our surroundings so much, and we're all products of what we ingest on a day-to-day basis. Can you tell me, so I know that was a giant tangent, but can you tell me a little bit about the role of not knowing in your own life and practice, and how it helps you and how it motivates you to keep growing?
Yeah. Yeah, giant tangent. I like that.
Sorry, man. That was great. Yep. I was on a roll there.
I love it. So not knowing. I mean, not knowing is such a central theme to Buddhism. And, you know, there's a famous koan where Dizong asked Phaon, where are you going? Phaon said, around on pilgrimage. Dizong said, what is the purpose of pilgrimage? Phaon said, I don't know. And Dizong said, not knowing is most intimate. So I just thought, you know, being is how intimacy is the theme of the thing. And I didn't put that in the book. It would be fun to say it here. So not knowing, basically, our knowing in the conventional way, which is having ideas about things or having them framed in particular ways, is wonderful. It's very helpful. But it's also very limiting, because it always puts what we're experiencing into that frame, which, as you say, comes from all these conditions, which have a tyrannical quality, to quote your puckish friend. So the thing is, if we can touch experience, or if experience can arise Without this overlay of knowing, or with a less gross overlay and a more subtle overlay, then our intimacy with the thing reveals itself, because basically our thinking is making separation. That's what it does. It separates things out so that they can be manipulated. So, not knowing is really one of the most powerful doorways to intimacy you can have. Now, the thing is, it lives in intimacy with knowing. So a good way to think about this is, if you think about someone you love, say your spouse comes to you, and I'm just going to make up this example as I go. So the spouse comes and they're upset about something. Now, conventionally, one thing you might do is just be like, I know what they're going to say, and I want to get out of it because I don't want to deal with it, or they're going to say I'm doing something wrong. And so you have a lot of knowing about where they're coming from, and you have a lot of knowing about your defenses. Well, you don't know about them. You just know they just operate in their own framework. And then you have the same argument you've had with your spouse 47,000 times. This happens to people all the time. It happens with your kids. It happens at work. It happens with yourself. So the thing is, all that knowing does have utility, but you want to be able to know it and then put it down. So I want to be like, I know that my spouse is unhappy, and I know that these things have made them unhappy before. And I know, using my normal mode of knowing, that I have all these reactivities. And then I can put all that down and just totally hear the person talk to me and be radically present, without having to back to the what and the how of mindfulness. What? You're paying attention to this person who's sharing something difficult with you, or maybe saying they're upset with you. And the how is non-judgmental, non-controlling, non-judgmental, non-controlling, and compassionate. And if you can hold those two things of your knowing and your not knowing together, you're going to get the best outcome.
You know, and you can almost back that out to that non-judgmental, that not controlling, and you can really even apply that to larger communities, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I kept thinking as I was reading your community section about fragmentation of community while you were talking about connecting communities, and everything you just said about non-judgmentalness. Were you thinking at all about fragmentation while you were writing the book?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the intimacy lives intimately with our fragmentation.
Yeah.
Because they're always, so intimacy is about non-dualism. So it both is separate from and not separate from. But that's fancy language. So let me get more to the point. So one of the things about intimacy within human consciousness, the way we understand it, is we want it. So we try and find ways to make it. And the way we make it usually includes an exclusion. So we say, I'm part of this group. I feel intimate with them. That is where I am intimate. And that means other people are separate. So the natural psychological impulse for intimacy usually creates both a feeling of intimacy and an idea of separation. So the practices in this book are designed to help us actually make it so we can have an intimacy where nothing is left out. Now, so, you know, that's just like if I'm progressive, and so I think that conservative people are terrible, right? And my progressive people are the people I feel close to. That's problematic. Now, at the same time, it's very reasonable, and people are suffer enormously at the hands of each other. And so we need to respect the need, the psychological need for us to find intimacy and feel separation. So there have been people who have traumatized me. I actually don't need to anymore personally, but there was time where I really need to actively separate from them because I needed that psychological protection. So we need to honor that. There are people, it's like you can't just say, oh, you should just love everybody. I don't think that is respectful. So I also want to say another thing about control. So a lot of people will say, wait a minute, if you're saying I shouldn't be controlling anything, and there's like violence being done, that is just bad. And I can understand why you would think that, but here's the thing. Controlling is about believing there's a separate object outside of you that could be manipulated. That's the basic way our consciousness is conditioned to function. It thinks there's objects that are separate from us that can be controlled to keep us safe. And that has some effectiveness, but it's very limited. So what I'm advocating for this book is cultivating a way of being where you can always just be focused on doing the liberative thing. And the thing is, the things that we think are in our control generally aren't. But we can keep coming back to this, I can do something liberative based on my understanding of connection to everyone.
So even if there is a gap, we can still return and repair fragmentation.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I've seen all kinds of personal and communal relationships get fragmented and find repair. And the repair doesn't ever come by people trying to control each other. It comes from people actually realizing connection.
Some of your big acknowledgments that you cite in the back of the book as some of your major influences seem to be figures in history that have done exactly what you just described, like Thich Nhat Hanh, bell hooks, Gandhi, Ida Wells, Dr. King. Can you tell me a little bit about what inspires you in some of these writings?
Well, they are various, but they're people, they tend to be people who none of them was perfect, and we could spend, you know, it's very reasonable to spend time talking about their faults and the things they did that were harmful. But here I'll emphasize, all of them, the ones you listed and many other people who I found most inspiring are people who didn't shy away from, they completely recognized the system of harm that they were part of, and then just kept stepping forward again and again for something that was liberative for both themselves and everyone else. And I usually wouldn't even make that distinction because their liberation is what Audre Lorde says, without community, there is no liberation. So like it has to be communal, but it's your own. So these are people who didn't shy away from the truth of suffering, but walked into it in a way that was freeing.
I love that. Okay. Well, Ben Connolly, this has been a delightful hour that we've spent together today talking about your new book, Mindfulness and Intimacy. I am super grateful to you for coming on Classical Ideas. Can you tell listeners where they can find you or find more of your work if they want to dig a little deeper?
Dig a little deeper in the storehouse of your love. Okay, I don't have like a website or anything. I don't know. Maybe I should. But if you want to find my books, I have three books, and they're easily available anywhere online. So if you just search my name, you'll find it. Although there is a Christian pastor with my name who also publishes books. So if they're books about being a missionary, those aren't mine. But God bless the other Ben Connolly author. So anyway, that's just easy to find with a simple Google search. I am going to be traveling extensively around the country to teach about mindfulness and intimacy. The easiest place to find out about where I'm doing that would be to go to the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center website. We have a page, and I have about 40 dates, and I'll be, going all over the place, and I'd love to meet people. That's why I do this. I like to connect with people and learn about their path of liberation and share mine.
Nice. I know earlier you mentioned that you look up to the teachings of Vashu Bandhu. You have a book specifically about Vashu Bandhu, don't you?
Yes, Inside Vashu Bandhu's Yogacara. I thought after I wandered around the country talking about that book, and everyone would just look at me when I said the title with blank eyes, because it is a little daunting, Vashu Bandhu Yogacara. So then I wrote this other book called Mindfulness and Intimacy. I thought that'd be a little easier to get your hands on. But inside Vashu Bandhu's Yogacara, I just love this teacher's vision. And I could totally see basically trying to, in a way, mindfulness and intimacy is about transmitting his vision of practice and liberation into a way of understanding that's more easily accessible to people who are not wanting to read ancient Buddhist texts. But he's a beautiful teacher, and I'm happy to have been able to write the book.
Fantastic. Well, Ben Connolly, thank you so much, sir. I look forward to speaking to you again sometime on Classical Ideas. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, this has been a wonderful conversation, Greg. I really appreciate the opportunity to meet.
Classical Ideas is produced by me, Greg Soden. Music on Classical Ideas is composed and performed by Derek Strybig. You can find his music at www.wearewarmmusic.com. If you like this show, please rate it on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can email me at classicalideas@outlook.com or find me on Patreon at patreon.com/classicalideaspodcast. Thanks so much for listening.